of it, started gasping and choking, but managed to hook my fingers in the back of Thomas's T-shirt. I tugged hard as he stepped, and I outweighed Thomas considerably. He stumbled again, and choking and gasping, I got ahead of him. I regained my lead and held it. The last 100 yards were the worst. The cold, dry air and sand burned at my throat. That sharp, painful dryness that only a long run and hard breathing can really do to you. I swerved off the sand toward the parking lot, Thomas's footsteps close behind me. I beat him back to the SUV by maybe 4 steps, slapped the back of the vehicle with my hand, then leaned against it, panting heavily. My throat felt like it had been baked in a kiln, and as soon as I could manage it, I took the keys out of my black nylon sports pouch. There were several keys on the ring, and I fumbled at them one at a time. After the 3rd wrong guess, I had a brief, sharp urge to break the window and grab the bottle of water I'd left sitting in the driver's seat. I managed to force myself to try the keys methodically until I found the right one. I opened the door, grabbed the bottle, twisted off the cap, and lifted it to ease the parched discomfort in my throat. I took my first gulp, and the water felt and tasted like it had come from God's own water cooler. It took the harshest edge off the burning thirst, but I needed more to ease the discomfort completely. Before I could swallow again, Thomas batted the water bottle out of my hand. It arched through the air and landed on the sand, spilling uselessly onto the beach. I spun on Thomas, staring at him in surprised anger. He met my gaze with weary gray eyes and said, "It's like that." I stared at him. "It's exactly like that." His expression didn't change as he went around and got into the SUV on the passenger side. I stayed where I was for a moment, trying to ignore my thirst. It was all but impossible to do so. I thought about living with that discomfort and pain, hour after hour, day after day, knowing that all I had to do was pick up a vessel filled with what I needed and empty it to make me feel whole. Would I be able to content myself with a quick splash of relief now and then? Would I be able to take enough to keep me alive? For a time, perhaps. But time itself would make the thirst no easier to bear. Time would inevitably weigh me down. It would become more difficult to concentrate and to sleep, which would in turn undermine my self-control, which would make it more difficult to concentrate and sleep. A vicious cycle. How long would I be able to last? Thomas had done it for most of a year. I wasn't sure I would have done as well in his place. I got into the SUV, closed the door, and said, "Thank you." My brother nodded. "What now?" "We go to 7-Eleven," I said. "Drinks are on you." He smiled a little and nodded. "Then what?" I took a deep breath. The run had helped me clear some of the crap out of my head. Talking to my brother had helped a little more. Understanding him a little better made me both more concerned and a bit more confident. I had my head together enough to see the next step I needed to take. "The apartment. You keep an eye on Butters," I said. "I'm hitting these spots on the map to see what I can find. If I can't turn up anything on my own, I might have to go to the Never Never for some answers."
"That's dangerous, isn't it?" he said.
I started the car and shrugged my shoulder. "It's a living." Chapter 13. I took a shower, got dressed, and left Thomas behind with the still sleeping Butters. Thomas settled down on the couch with a candle, a book, and an old U.S. cavalry saber he'd picked up in an estate sale and honed to a scalpel's edge. I left the sawed-off shotgun on the coffee table within arm's reach, and Thomas nodded his thanks to me. "Keep an eye on him?" I asked. Thomas turned a page. "Nothing will touch him." Mouse settled down on the floor between Butters and the door and huffed out a breath. I got into the SUV and got out Mort's map. I headed for the nearest magical hot spot marked in bloody ink on the map, the spot of sidewalk on Wacker. It was a bitch to find a parking place. It's never easy in Chicago, and I had a shot at a pretty good spot on the street, but while the Beetle would have managed just fine, the SS Loner would have had to smash cars on either side a few inches apart to fit. I wound up taking out a mortgage to pay for a parking space at a garage, walked a couple of city blocks, and proceeded down the street with my wizard senses alert, feeling for the dark energy that the city's dead had found. I found the spot on the sidewalk outside of a corner pharmacy. It was so small, I had walked almost completely through it before I felt it. It felt almost like walking into air conditioning. The residual magic felt cold, like the other dark power I'd touched, terribly cold, and my skin erupted in goosebumps. I stopped on the spot, closed my eyes, and focused on the remaining energy. It felt strange, somehow. Dawn had dispersed most of the energy that had been there, but even as an aftertaste of the magic that had been worked there, the cold was dizzying. I'd felt dark power similar to this before today. Similar, but not identical. There was something about this that was unlike the horrible aura surrounding Gravain, or that I had sensed from wielders of black magic in my past. This was undeniably the same power, but it somehow lacked the greasy, nauseating sense of corruption I'd felt before. That was all I could sense. I frowned and looked around. There was a spot on the sidewalk that might have been a half-cleaned bloodstain, or might have been spilled coffee. Around me, business day commuters came and went, some of them pausing to give me annoyed glares. Cars purred by on the street. I checked at the pharmacy, but the place had been closed the night before, and no one had been there or heard about anything out of the ordinary. I checked the neighboring places of business, but it was a part of town where not much was open after 6 or 7 in the evening, and no one had seen or heard about anything out of the ordinary. Most of the time, the investigation business is like that. You do a lot of looking and not finding. The cure for it is to do more looking. I walked back to the SUV and went to the next spot on the map, at the Field Museum. The Field Museum is on Lakeshore Drive and occupies a whole block north of Soldier's Field. I felt a brief flash of gratitude that things usually went to hell during the work week. If this had been a Sunday with the bears at home, I'd have had to park and then backpack in from Outer Mongolia. As it was, I got a spot in the smaller parking lot in the same block as the museum, which cost me only a portion of the national gross income. I walked to the entrance from the parking lot and slowed my steps for a few strides. There were 2 patrol cars and an ambulance parked outside the Field Museum's main entrance. Aha. This stop looked like it might be a bit more interesting than the last one. The doors had just opened for normal visiting hours, and it cost me yet more of my money to get a ticket. My wallet was getting even more anorexic than usual. At this rate, I wouldn't be able to afford to protect mankind from the perils of black magic. Hell's bells, that would be really embarrassing. I went in the front entrance. It's impressively big. The first thing my eyes landed on was the crown jewel of the Field Museum. Sue, the largest, most complete, and most beautifully preserved skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus rex ever discovered. They're the actual petrified bones, too. None of this cheap plastic modeling crap for the tourists. The museum prided itself on the authenticity of the exhibit, and with reason. There's no way to stand in Sue's shadow, to see the bones of the enormous hunter, its size, its power, its enormous teeth, without feeling excruciatingly edible. Late October is not the museum's high traffic season, and I saw only a couple of other visitors in the great entrance hall. Museum security was in evidence, a couple of men in brown quasi-uniforms, and an older fellow with graying hair and a comfortable-looking suit. The man in the suit stood next to an unobtrusive doorway, talking to a couple of uniformed police officers, neither of whom I recognized. I moseyed over closer to the 3 of them, casually browsing over various exhibits, until I could get close enough to listen in. "Damnedest thing," the old security chief was saying. "Never would have figured that this kind of business would happen here." "People are people," said the older of the 2 cops, a black man in his 40s. "We can all get pretty crazy." The younger cop was a little overweight and had a short haircut the color of steamed carrots. "Sir, do you know of anyone who might have had some kind of argument with Mr. Bartlesby?" "Doctor," the security man said. "Dr. Bartlesby." "Right," said the younger cop, writing on a notepad. But do you know of anyone like that? The security man shook his head.
Dr. Bartlesby was a crotchety old bastard. No one liked him much, but I don't know of anyone who disliked him enough to kill him.
Did he associate with anyone here?
He had a pair of assistants, the security chief replied. Grad students, I think. Young woman and a young man.
They a couple? The younger cop asked.
Not that I could tell, the security chief said.
Names? The older cop asked.
Alicia Nelson was the girl. The guy was Chinese or something. Lee Sean or something.
Does the museum have records on them? The cop asked.
I don't think so. They came in with Dr. Bartlesby.
How long have you known the doctor? The older cop asked.
About 2 months, the security chief said. He was a visiting professor doing a detailed examination of one of the traveling exhibits. It's already been taken down and packed up. He was due to leave in a few more days.
Which exhibit? The young cop asked.
One of the Native American displays, the security man supplied. Cahokian artifacts.
Ca-what? The older cop asked.
Cahokian, the security chief said.
Amerin tribe that was all over the Mississippi River Valley 700 or 800 years ago, I guess.
Were these artifacts valuable? Asked the older cop. Arguably, the security chief said. But their value is primarily academic. Pottery shards, old tools, stone weapons, that kind of thing. They wouldn't be easy to liquidate.
People do crazy things, the young cop said, still writing.
If you say so, the security chief said. Look, fellas, the museum would really like to get this cleared up as quickly as possible. It's been hours already. Can't we get the remains taken out now?
Sorry, sir, the older cop said. Not until the detectives are done documenting the scene.
How long will that take?
The security chief asked. The older cop's radio clicked, and he took it off his belt and had a brief conversation.
Sir, he told the security chief, they're removing the body now. Forensics will be over in a couple of hours to sweep the room.
Why the delay? The chief asked. The cop answered with a shrug.
But until then, I'm afraid we'll have to close down access to the crime scene.
There are a dozen different senior members of the staff with offices off of that hallway, the security chief protested.
I'm sure they'll finish up as quickly as they can, sir, the cop said, though his tone brooked no debate.
Told my boss I'd give it a try, the chief sighed. You want to come explain it to him?
Glad to, the cop said with a forced smile. Lead the way.
The two cops and the security chief strode off together, presumably to talk to somebody with an office, a receptionist, and an irritatingly skewed perspective on the importance of isolating a crime scene. I chewed on my lip. I was pretty sure that the apparent murder the cops were talking about and my hot spot of dark magic had to be related to each other. But if the hot spot was located on a murder site, it would be shut away from any access. Forensics could spend hours, even days, going over a room for evidence. That meant that if I wanted to get a look around, I had to move immediately. From what the cops had said, forensics wasn't there yet. The men moving the body were part of the new civilian agency the city government was employing to transport corpses around town, judging from the ambulance outside. Both cops were with the security chief, which would mean that at most there was maybe a detective and a cop at the crime scene. There might be a chance that I could get close enough to see something. It took me about 2 seconds to make up my mind. The minute the security chief was out of sight, I slipped through the nondescript doorway, down a flight of stairs, and into the plain and unassuming hallways meant for the field museum's staff instead of its visitors. I passed a small alcove with a fridge, a counter, and a coffee machine. I picked up a cup of coffee, a bagel, a newspaper, and a spiral notebook someone had left there. I piled up everything in my arms and tried to look like a bored academic on his way to his office. I had no clue where I was going yet, but I tried to walk like I knew what I was doing, reaching out with my arcane senses in an effort to feel where the remnants of the hot spot might be. I chose intersections methodically, left each time. I hit a couple of dead ends, but tried to keep close track of where I was going. The complex of tunnels and hallways under the Field Museum could swallow a small army without needing a glass of water, and I couldn't afford to get lost down there. It took me 15 minutes to find it. One hallway had been marked with crime scene tape, and I homed in on it. Even before I turned down the hall, my senses prickled with uneasy cold. I'd found my hot spot of necromantic energy, and there was a murder scene at its center. I heard footsteps and slipped to one side, remaining still as a pair of cops in suits came out, arguing quietly with each other about the shortest path outside so that they could smoke. They'd been cooped up with the body, taking pictures and documenting the scene since before any place had been open for breakfast, and neither one of them sounded like he was in a good mood.
"Rollins," said one of them into his radio, "where the hell are you?"
"Talking to some administrator," came a reply, the voice of the older cop from upstairs.
"How soon can you get down here to watch the site?"
"Give me a few minutes."
"Damn it," cursed the other detective. "Bastard is doing this on purpose."
The one with the radio nodded.
"Screw this. I've been on duty since noon yesterday. We've got the scene documented. It'll keep for 2 minutes while he walks his slow ass down here."
The other detective nodded his agreement, and they left. I set my props aside and slipped under the tape and down the hallway. There were office doors every couple of steps, all closed. At the end of the hall, a door stood open, the lights on. I might have only a few minutes, and if I was going to learn anything, it had to be now. I hurried forward. There might not have been a body there anymore, but even before I saw it, the room stank of death. It's an elusive scent, something that you get as a bonus to other smells, rather than a distinctive smell of its own. The thick, sweet odor of blood was in the air, mixed in with the faint stench of offal. There was a musty, moldy smell of old things long underground, too, as well as a few traces of something spicier, maybe some kind of incense. The death scent was mixed all through it, something sharp and unnerving, halfway between burned meat and cheap, ammonia-based cleaner. My stomach rolled uncomfortably, and the rising sense of dark energy didn't help me keep it calm. The office was a fairly large one. Shelves and filing cabinets lined the walls. Three desks sat clumped together in the middle of the room. A small refrigerator sat in the corner, near an old couch and coffee table, littered with mostly empty boxes of Chinese takeout and a laptop computer. Books and boxes filled the shelves. The desks were cluttered with books, notebooks, folders, and a few personal articles, a novelty coffee mug, a couple of picture frames, and some recent popular novels. Everything had been splattered with blood and dark magic. The blood had dried out, and most of it was either red-black or dark brown. There was a large pool on the floor between the door and the nearest desk, dried into a sticky sludge. A sharp, almost straight line marked where the corpse had been lifted, probably peeling up the hem of a jacket or coat from where it had been stuck to the floor. Droplets had splattered the walls, the desk, the photographs, the novels, and the novelty mugs. I hated blood. As a decorating theme, it left something to be desired, and it smelled horrible. My stomach twisted again, and I fought to keep down the donuts I'd grabbed at the convenience store. I closed my eyes and then forced myself to open them again, to look. The only way to avoid more scenes like this was to look at this one, figure out who had done it, and then go stop them from doing it again. I pushed my revulsion away and focused on the scene, searching for details. There were a few smears of blood on the floor, but none on the sides, surface, or edge of the nearest desk. That meant that the victim hadn't moved much after he'd gone down. Either he'd been held down, or he'd bled out so quickly that he hadn't had time to crawl toward the nearest phone on the desk to call for help. I looked up. There wasn't much blood on the ceiling. That didn't prove anything, but if someone had opened his throat, there would almost certainly have been blood sprayed all over it. Any other kind of bleeding wound would probably have left the victim, evidently Dr. Bartlesby, able to function, at least for a couple of minutes. He'd probably been held down. I looked down. There was part of a footprint in blood on the floor, leading away. It looked like part of the heel of an athletic shoe, and not a large one either. Probably a woman's shoe, or a large child's. For the sake of my ability to sleep at night, I hoped it was an adult's shoe. Children shouldn't see such things. Then again, who should? On an entirely different level, the room was even more disturbing. The dark power here was not the pure, silent cold I'd felt on the sidewalk on Wacker. It felt corrupt, dark, somehow mutilated. There was a sense of malicious glee to the residue of whatever magic had been worked here. Someone had used their power to murder a man, and they had loved doing it. Worse, it was a distinctly different aura than I had felt near either Cowell or Gravain. Magical workings didn't leave behind an exact fingerprint that could be traced to a given wizard, but intuition told me that this working had been sloppier and more frenetic than something Gravain would have done, and messier than Cowell would prefer. But it was strong. Stronger magic than almost anything I had ever done. Whoever was behind the spell that had been wrought here was at least as powerful as I was. Maybe stronger. "Huh," drawled a voice from behind me. "I thought that was you." I stiffened and turned around. The older of the two cops from upstairs stood 10 feet down the hall from me, one hand resting casually on the butt of his sidearm. His dark face was wary, but not openly hostile, and his stance one of caution, but not alarm. The name tag on his jacket read Rawlins. "Thought who was me?" I asked him. "Harry Dresden," he said. "The wizard, the guy Murphy hires for S.I. "Yeah," I said. "I guess that's me." He nodded. "I saw you upstairs. You didn't look like a typical museum patron." "It was the big leather coat, wasn't it?" I said. "That helped," Rawlins acknowledged. "What are you doing down here?"
"Just looking," I said. "I haven't gone into the room."
"Yeah, you can tell that from how I haven't arrested you yet."
Rawlins looked past me into the room, and his expression sobered.
"Hell of a thing in there."
"Yeah," I said.
"Something don't feel right about it," he said. "Just, I don't know, sets my teeth on edge, more than usual. I've seen knife ends before. This is different."
"Yeah," I said. "It is." Dark eyes flicked back to me, and the old cop exhaled.
"This is something from down S.I.'s way?"
"Yeah," he grunted.
"Murphy send you?"
"Not exactly," I said.
"Why you here, then?"
"Because I don't like things that put cops' teeth on edge," I said. "You guys have any suspects?"
"For someone who just happened to be walking by, you got a lot of questions," he said.
"For a beat cop in charge of securing the scene, you were asking plenty of your own," I said. "Upstairs, with museum security." He grinned, teeth very white.
"Shoot, I've been a detective before, twice."
I lifted my eyebrows.
"Busted back down?"
"Both times, on account of I have an attitude problem," Rawlins said. I gave him a lopsided smile.
"You going to arrest me?"
"Depends," he said.
"On what?"
"On why you're here." He met my gaze directly, openly, his hand still on his gun. I didn't meet his eyes for very long. I glanced over my shoulder, debating on how to answer, and decided to go with a little sincerity. "There are some bad people in town. I don't think the police can get them. I'm trying to find them before they hurt anyone else." He studied me for a long minute. Then he took his hand off the gun and reached into his coat. He tossed me a folded newspaper. I caught it and unfolded it. It was some kind of academic newsletter, and on the cover page was a photograph of a portly old man with sideburns down to his jaw, together with a smiling young woman and a young man with Asian features. The caption under the picture read, "Visiting Professor Charles Bartlesby and his assistants, Alicia Nelson, Lee Xian, prepare to examine Cahokian collection at the FMNH Chicago."
"That's the victim in the middle," Rawlins said. "His assistants shared the office with him. They have not been answering their cell phone numbers and are not in their apartments."
"Suspects?" I asked. He shrugged.
"Not many people murder strangers," he said. "They were the only ones in town who knew the victim. Came in with him from England somewhere."
I looked from the newsletter up to Rawlins and frowned.
"Why are you helping me?"
He lifted his eyebrows.
"Helping you? You could have found that anywhere, and I never saw you."
"Understood," I said, But why? He leaned against the wall and folded his arms.
Because when I was a young cop, I went running down an alley when I heard a woman scream. And I saw something. Something that... His face became remote. Something that has given me bad dreams for about 30 years. This thing strangling a girl. I push it away from her, empty my gun into it. It picks me up and slams my head into a wall a few times. I figured Mama Rollins's baby boy was about to go the way of the dodo. What happened? I asked. Lieutenant Murphy's father showed up with a shotgun loaded with rock salt and killed it. And when the sun comes up, it burns this thing's corpse like it had been soaked in gasoline. Rollins shook his head. I owed her old man, and I've seen enough of the streets to know that she's been doing a lot of good. You've been helping her with that. I nodded. Thank you, I told him. He nodded. Don't really feel like losing my job for you, Dresden. Get out before someone sees you.
Something occurred to me. You heard about the Forensic Institute? He shrugged at me.
Sure, every cop has.
I mean, what happened there last night? I said. Rollins shook his head.
I haven't heard of anything.
I frowned at him. A grisly murder at the morgue would have been all over the place, in police scuttlebutt, if not in the newspapers.
You haven't? Are you sure?
Sure, I'm sure. I nodded at him and walked down the hallway.
Hey,
he said. I looked over my shoulder.
Can you stop them?
Rollins asked.
I hope so.
He glanced at the bloodied room and then back at me.
All right. Good hunting, kid.
Chapter 14.
Wow, Butters said, fiddling with the control panel on the SUV. This thing has everything. Satellite radio stations, and I bet I could put my whole CD collection inside the changer on this player. And oh, cool, check it out. It's got an onboard GPS, too, so we can't get lost.
Butters pushed a button on the control panel. A calm voice emerged from the dashboard.
Now entering Helsinki.
I arched an eyebrow at the dashboard and then at Butters. Maybe the car is lost.
Maybe you're interfering with its computer, too, Butters said.
You think? He smiled tightly, checking his seatbelt for the 10th time.
Just so we're clear, I have no problems with hiding, Harry. I mean, if you're worried about my ego or something, don't. I'm fine with the hiding. Happy, even.
I pulled off the highway. The green lawns and tended trees of the industrial park hosting the Forensic Institute appeared as the SUV rolled up the ramp.
Try to relax, Butters.
He jerked his head in a nervous, negative shake.
I don't want to get killed. Or arrested. I'm really bad at being arrested. Or killed.
It's a calculated risk, I said. We need to find out what Gravain wanted with you.
And we're taking me to work. Why?
Think about it. What would have happened if they found you missing, blood all over the place, the building ransacked, and Phil's corpse lying in the morgue or on the lawn outside?
Someone would have gotten fired, Butters said.
Yeah, and they would have locked down the building to search for evidence. And they would have grabbed you and locked you away somewhere for questioning, at least.
So?
Butters asked. If Gravain cleaned up what happened at the morgue, it means he didn't want too much official attention focused there. Whatever he wants from you, I'm betting it's still in the building. I pulled into the industrial park. We have to find it.
Eduardo Mendoza? He asked me. Offhand, I can't think of any other reason for someone to want to grab your friendly neighborhood assistant medical examiner, I said. Gravain's got to be interested in a corpse at the morgue, and that one was the only one that seemed a little odd.
Harry, Butters said, if this guy really is a necromancer, a wizard of the dead, then why the hell would he need a plain old vanilla science nerd like me?
That's the $64,000 question, I said, and we have another reason, too.
The museum doctor guy, right? Butters asked.
I nodded at him and parked in the lot next to Butters' ruined little truck.
Right. I need to know what killed him.
Hell, any information could be useful. Butters exhaled.
Well, I don't know what I'll be able to manage.
Anything is more than I have now. He looked around warily.
Do you think Gravain or his buddy is out there right now, watching for, you know, me?
I pulled open my coat and showed Butters my shoulder holster and gun. Then I reached behind me and drew out my staff from the back of the SUV. If they show up, I'm going to ruin their whole day. He chewed on his lip.
You can do that, right?
I took a look around and said, Butters, trust me. If there's one thing I'm good at, it's ruining people's day. He let out a nervous little laugh.
You can say that again.
If there's one thing I'm good at, I began. Butters punched me lightly on the arm, and I smiled at him. We'll get in and out as quick as we can, get you back under cover. I think we've got it under control. I killed the SUV's ignition and pulled out the key. The truck shuddered, and a warbling, wailing sound came from the dashboard. For a second, I expected someone to shout, Red alert! All hands to battle stations! Instead, there was a hiccup of sound from the truck, and then a smooth, recorded voice reporting,
Warning! The door is ajar! The door is ajar!
I blinked at the dashboard. It repeated the warning several more times, getting a little slower and lower pitched each time, then droned into a basso rumble, followed by silence. That was not an omen, I said firmly.
Right,
Butters replied in a faint voice.
Because stuff is always messing up around you.
Exactly, I said. I tried to think of a way to wring positive spin from that last statement, but I wasn't up to the mental gymnastics. Come on. The sooner we get moving, the sooner we get you out of here.
Okay,
he said. And the pair of us got out of the SUV and headed for the Forensic Institute. As we approached the door, I started limping and leaning on my staff a little, as if I needed the support. Butters opened the door for me, and I hobbled in with a pained expression on my face as we approached the security desk. I didn't know the guard on duty. He was in his mid-20s and looked athletic. He watched us coming, squinting a little, and when we were well inside, his eyebrows lifted. Dr. Butters, he said, evidently surprised. I haven't seen you in a while.
Casey,
Butters said, giving him a jerky nod of the head.
Hey, I like the new haircut. Is Dr. Brioche in?
He's working now, Casey said. Room one, I think. What are you doing here?
Hoping to avoid a lecture,
Butters replied dryly. He clipped his identification to his coat.
I forgot to file some forms, and if I don't get them done before the mail goes out, Brioche will scold me until my eyes bleed.
Casey nodded and looked me over. Who's this?
Harry Dresden, Butters said. He's got to sign off on the forms. He's a consultant for the police department. Harry, this is Casey O'Rourke.
Charmed, I said, and handed him the laminated identification card Murphy had issued me to get me through police lines to crime scenes. As I did, I felt another cold pocket of dark energy. Gravain had murdered and then reanimated Phil while the poor guy was sitting at his desk. Casey examined the card, checked my face against the picture on it, and passed it back to me with a polite smile.
You want me to tell Dr. Brioche you're here, Dr. Butters?
Butters shuddered.
Not particularly.
Right, Casey said and waved us past. We were almost out of the entry hall when he spoke again.
Doctor, did you see Phil this morning?
Butters hesitated for a second before he turned around.
He was there at the desk the last time I saw him, but I had to leave for an early dentist appointment. Why?
Oh, he wasn't at the desk when I got here, Casey said. Everything was locked down, and the security system was armed.
Maybe he had somewhere to be, too, Butters suggested.
Maybe, Casey agreed.
There was a faint frown line between his eyes.
He didn't tell me anything, though. I mean, I'd have to come in early if he had an appointment or something.
Beats me, Butters said.
Casey squinted at Butters and then nodded slowly.
Okay. I just wouldn't want him to get in trouble over breaking protocol.
You know Phil,
Butters said. Casey rolled his eyes and nodded, then went back to filling out some kind of paperwork. Butters and I slipped away from the entry hall and down to Butters's usual examination room. The place had been put back together. His desk rested in its usual spot, piled with papers and his computer. Whoever had cleaned up the room had done a fairly good job of it.
Casey knows something,
Butters said the minute the door was shut.
He suspects something.
That's what they pay security to do, I said. Don't let it rattle you.
Butters nodded, looking around the examination room. He walked over to his POCA suit, still piled in the corner.
At least they didn't wreck this, he said.
Then he let out a short laugh.
Man, are my priorities skewed or what?
Everyone has something they love, I said.
He nodded.
Okay. So, what do we do now?
First things first, I said. Can you get a look at Bartlesby's corpse? Butters nodded and walked over to his computer. I backed up and stood against the wall. Butters started the thing up and spent a minute or two waggling a mouse and stabbing at keys with his forefinger. Then he whistled.
Wow. Bartlesby's body got here about an hour ago, and it's been flagged for immediate examination. Brioche is doing it.
Is that unusual? I asked. He nodded.
It means someone really wants to know about the victim. Someone in government or law enforcement, maybe.
He wrinkled up his nose.
Plus, it was pretty horrific. Brioche will get some press out of it. Of course he took this one for himself.
Can you get to it? I asked. Butters frowned and tapped a few more keys. Then he looked up at the clock.
Maybe. Brioche is working in room one right now, but he's got to be almost finished with whatever he's doing. Bartlesby's corpse is in room two. If I hurry...
He stood up and scurried for the door.
Wait here.
You sure? I asked him. He nodded.
Someone really would get suspicious if they saw you roaming around. If I need you, I'll give you a signal.
What signal?
I'll imitate the scream of a terrified little girl,
he said with a waggle of his eyebrows. He headed out the door.
Back in a minute.
Butters wasn't gone long, and he slipped back into the room before 5 minutes had passed. He looked a little shaky. You all right? I asked. He nodded.
Couldn't stay there for long. I heard Brioche come out of room one.
You see the body?
Yeah, Butters said with a shudder. It was already stripped and laid out. Bad stuff, Harry. He had 30 or 40 stab wounds in his upper thorax. Someone carved his face up, too. His nose, ears, eyelids, and lips were in a sandwich baggie next to his head.
He took a deep breath.
Someone had sliced off the quadriceps on both legs. They were missing, and he'd been eviscerated.
I frowned.
How? A big X shape cut across his abdomen. Then they peeled him open like a Chinese takeout box. He was missing his stomach and most of his intestines. There might have been other organs gone, too.
Yick, I said.
Extremely.
Could you see anything else?
No. Even if I wanted to, there wasn't time for more than a quick look.
He walked over to a rolling stand of medical instruments.
Why would someone do that to him? What possible purpose could it have served?
Maybe some kind of ritual, I said. You've seen that before. Butters nodded. He went through the motions of pulling on an apron, mask, gloves, cap, the works.
I still don't get it. You know?
I did know. Butters didn't have it in him to comprehend the kind of violence, hatred, and bloodlust that had fallen upon the late Bartlesby. That kind of utter disregard for the sanctity of life simply didn't exist in his personal world, and it left him at a total loss when confronted with it face to face. Or, I said, a thought occurring to me, it might have been something else. Anthropomancy. He walked over to one of the freezers and cracked it open.
What's that?
An attempt to divine the future or gain information by reading human entrails. Butters turned to me slowly, his face sickened.
You're kidding.
I shook my head.
It's possible. Does it work? He asked.
It's extremely powerful and dangerous magic, I answered. Anyone who does it has to kill someone and gets an immediate death sentence if the council learns of it. If it didn't work, no one would bother. Butters' mouth hardened into a firm line.
That's really wrong.
He frowned over the sentence and then nodded.
Wrong?
I agree. He turned back to the freezer, checked a toe tag, and then hauled a rolling exam table over to it.
This might take me a little while, he said. An hour and a half, maybe more.
You want a hand with that? I asked. I hoped he didn't. Butters, bless him, shook his head. He walked over to his desk and flicked on his CD player. Polka music filled the room.
I'd really rather do this alone.
You sure? I asked.
Just listen for a girly scream, he said. Can you wait for me up front?
I nodded, leaned my staff in the corner, and left him in the room. He locked the door behind me, and I wandered up to sit down in the waiting area near the front doors.
I took a chair that put the wall to my back, and where I could see Casey's video monitor, the front door, and the door leading back to the examination rooms. I leaned my head back against the wall, with my eyes mostly closed, and waited. Over the next hour, one doctor came in and another left. The mailman showed up with the day's deliveries, as did the UPS truck. An ambulance arrived with a cadaver of an old woman that Casey rolled away, presumably into storage. Then, a young couple came in. The girl was about 5'6" and pleasantly pretty, even without much in the way of makeup. She was dressed in sandals, a simple blue sundress, and a wool jacket. Her hair was cut into a bob full of unruly brown curls, and her eyes were bloodshot with fatigue. The young man wore a simple, well-cut business suit. He was a little under 6 feet tall, had Asian features, wire-rimmed glasses, wide shoulders, and wore his hair in a long ponytail. I recognized them. Alicia Nelson and Lee Xian from the picture on the cover of the newsletter Rawlins had given me. Dr. Bartlesby's missing assistants had come to the morgue. I remained very still and tried to think thoughts that would make me blend in with the wall. They walked to the security desk and stood so close to me that I didn't need to bother with listening to them. "Good morning," Alicia said, producing a driver's license and showing it to Casey. "My name is Alicia Nelson. I'm the late Dr. Bartlesby's assistant. I understand that his remains have been brought here." Casey regarded her without much in the way of expression. "Ma'am, we do not make that kind of information available to the public in order to protect the relatives of the deceased." She nodded, drew an envelope out of her purse, and passed that to Casey as well. "The doctor had no surviving family or next of kin," she said. "But he granted me power of attorney over his estate 2 years ago. The paperwork is all in order." Casey scanned it, frowning. Alicia pushed brown curls wearily from her eyes. "Please, sir, the doctor had several personal effects which I need to take into custody as soon as possible. Passwords, credit cards, keys, that sort of thing. They were in his wallet."
"What's the rush?" Casey drawled.
"Some of his effects could potentially grant a thief access to his accounts and security boxes. As you can see in the documents, he wanted control of them to pass to me, until I could arrange to have them passed on to the charities he patronized."
Casey folded up the pages again and put them back in the envelope.
"Ma'am, you're going to have to speak with our director, Dr. Brioche. I'm sure he'll be happy to help you out."
"All right," Alicia agreed. "Is he available?"
"I'll go speak to him," Casey said. "If you wait here, please."
"Of course," the girl replied.
She waited for Casey to go through the security door, and then spun on her heel and stalked over to the entrance, staring out at the morning sunlight. Her posture was stiff with anger. She leaned her forearm on the glass door and pressed her forehead to it. The tall, young man, Lee Xian, had remained silent the whole while. He followed her over to the door and spoke in a quiet voice I could scarcely hear. I narrowed my eyes and listened.
"Back at any moment," Xian murmured. "We should sit down."
"Don't tell me what to do," Alicia shot back in a heated whisper. "I'm weary, not idiotic."
"You should get some rest before you do anything more," Xian said. "I don't see why you're playing games. You should have let me follow the guard back."
"Stop thinking with your stomach," the girl growled. "It's bad enough that you lost control without adding a further lack of discipline to the situation."
"We are not here because I stopped to eat,"
Xian replied, anger of his own in his whisper.
"If you hadn't indulged yourself, we wouldn't face this problem."
The girl spun from the glass, facing Xian squarely, her face contorted with pride and anger.
"Your attitude, Lee, is making you part of the problem, not part of the solution."
The long-haired man went white and cringed back from the girl. His face rippled, a sort of slithery motion just beneath the surface of his skin that stretched his features grotesquely, causing a slight sinking of the eyes, a slight elongation of the jaw. He let out a gasp, and when his mouth opened, I could see the teeth of a carnivore. It happened for only a second, but I averted my eyes before he might have noticed me watching him. If he had seen me, I would have been in immediate danger. I'd seen a flash of Li Xian's true face. He was a ghoul. Ghouls are preternatural predators who derive their primary sustenance from devouring human flesh. Fresh, cold, rotting, they don't care as long as it gets into their bellies. My stomach turned. Butters said that someone had removed Bartlesby's quadriceps, the long, strong muscles on the front of the thigh. It had been Xian. He'd carved himself stakes from the old man's corpse. If he suspected that I knew what he was, he might decide to protect himself with extreme prejudice, and that would be bad. Ghouls are quick, strong, and harder to kill than a juicy rumor about the president. I'd fought ghouls before, and it wasn't something I wanted to repeat if I could avoid it, especially given that I'd left my staff in Butters' office. Xian recovered his normal appearance and lowered his eyes. He bowed his head to Alicia.
"Do I make myself clear?" the girl whispered.
"Yes, my lord," Xian replied.
"Lord?"
I thought. My mind raced over the possibilities. Alicia exhaled and pressed her thumb against the spot between her eyebrows.
"Don't talk, Xian. Just don't talk. We'll all be happier and safer."
She breezed past him, back to the little waiting area, and sat down. She picked up a copy of Newsweek, sitting out on an end table, and began to flick through it, while Xian remained standing near the door. I pretended to be drowsing. Casey returned a couple of minutes later and said,
"Miss Nelson, it's going to be a while before Dr. Brioche can see you."
"How long?" she asked, smiling.
"An hour or so, at least," Casey said. "He says that if you'd like to make an appointment for this afternoon, that he'd be glad to s—"
"No," she interrupted him, shaking her head firmly. "Some of his business is time-critical, and I need to recover his effects at the earliest possible opportunity. Please tell him that I will wait." Casey lifted his eyebrows and then shrugged.
"Yes, ma'am."
I blinked my eyes a few times and then sat up straight, stretching.
"Oh, hey, Casey,"
I mumbled, standing. I feigned a limp and went to the desk.
"I left my cane in Butters' office. Would it be okay to go back and grab it?"
Casey nodded.
"One second."
He picked up the phone, and a second later I heard polka music pumping through the little speaker.
"Doctor, your consultant friend forgot something in your office. You want me to send him back?"
He listened, nodding, and then waved me at the door, buzzing me through. I hurried back to Butters' examination room and knocked. Butters unlocked the door to let me in.
"Hurry," I told him, glancing back down the hall. "We've got to go."
Butters gulped.
"What's going on?"
"There are some bad guys here."
"Gravain?"
he asked. "No, new bad guys," I said.
"More of them?"
Butters said.
"That's not fair."
"I know. It's getting to be like Satan's reunion tour around here." I shook my head. "Is there a back door?"
"Yes."
"Good. Grab your stuff and let's go." Butters gestured at the exam table.
"But what about Eduardo?"
I chewed on my lip. "You find out anything?"
"Not a lot," he said. "A car hit him. He suffered some pretty massive blunt impact trauma. He died."
I frowned and took a few steps toward the corpse.
"There's gotta be more to it than that."
Butters shrugged.
"If there is, I didn't see it."
I frowned down at the dead man. He was a painfully skinny specimen. His abdomen had been opened with a neat Y incision. There was a lot of blood and disgusting-looking grayish flesh. Broken, jagged bone protruded from the skin of one leg. One hand had been crushed into pulp. And his face looked familiar. I recognized him.
"Butters," I said. "What was this guy's name?"
"Eduardo Mendoza."
"His full name," I said.
"Oh, Eduardo Antonio Mendoza."
"Antonio," I said.
"It's him. It's Tony."
"Who?"
Butters asked. "Bony Tony Mendoza," I said, excited. "He's a smuggler." Butters tilted his head at me.
"A smuggler? Not like Han Solo, I guess."
"No, he's a ballooner."
"What's that?"
I gestured at his head. He'd done time in a carnival as a sword swallower when he was a kid. He would fill up a balloon with jewels or drugs or whatever other small items he wanted to move around. Then he swallowed the balloon with a string tied to it. Check at the back of his mouth. He'd wedged the string between two of his back teeth and pull the balloon out when the coast was clear.
That's silly,
Butters said, but he went over to the corpse and pried its jaws open. He adjusted an overhead work lamp on a flexible stand and peered down past Bony Tony's teeth.
Holy crap! It's there.
He fished around for a few moments while I went back to the door and picked up my staff. I looked back to see Butters drag from the corpse's mouth a yellow-white condom with its end closed and a heavy piece of kite cord knotted around it.
What's in it? I asked.
Hang on.
Butters sliced the condom open with a scalpel and withdrew a small rectangle of dark plastic about the size of a keychain ornament.
What is that? I asked him.
It's a jump drive, he said, frowning.
Oh, what?
You plug it into your computer so you can store data on it when you want to move files around to other machines.
Information, I said, frowning. Bony Tony was smuggling information. Something Gravain needed to know. Maybe the two out front wanted it too. Maybe that's why he got killed.
Ugh,
Butters said. Can you read the information? I asked him.
Maybe, he said. I can try another machine.
Not now, I said. No time. We need to get out of here.
Why?
Because things have just become a lot more dangerous.
They have?
Butters chewed on his lip.
Why?
Because, I said, Bony Tony worked for John Marcone.
Chapter 15. Gentleman Johnny Marcone was the most powerful figure in Chicago's criminal underworld. If there was an illegal enterprise afoot, Marcone was either in charge of it or had been paid for the privilege of its operating in his territory. Bony Tony had done most of a dime in a federal penitentiary for trafficking in narcotics, and after that, he'd moved into less politically incorrect areas of the business. He mostly dealt in moving stolen goods, everything from jewels to hot furniture. I wasn't exactly sure where Bony Tony ranked in Marcone's criminal hierarchy, but Marcone wasn't the sort of person who would take the murder of one of his people lightly, not without his approval, at any rate. Marcone would know about Bony Tony's death soon, if he didn't already. He was sure to get involved in one fashion or another, and the best way for him to get to whoever had killed Bony Tony would be to get his hands on whatever it was they wanted. I had to get Butters somewhere safe. The quicker, the better. But until I knew what was on that storage device, I couldn't judge what would be safe for him and what wouldn't.
Harry,
Butters said, as if he was repeating himself. I blinked a couple of times.
What? Do you want to hang on to this? He said in the same tone.
He stepped over to me and offered me the little slip of plastic.
No,
I snapped and took two steps back.
Butters, get that the hell away from me.
He froze in place, staring at me, his expression somewhere between confused and wounded.
I'm sorry.
I took a deep breath. Where the hell was my concentration? This was no time to start spacing out on trains of thought, no matter how relevant to the circumstances.
Don't be, I said. Look, that thing doesn't have any moving parts, right? Electronic storage?
Yeah.
Then I don't dare touch it, I said. Remember how messed up my x-rays were?
He nodded.
You're saying that the data on here could get messed up the same way.
I could never have cassette tapes after I started working magic, I said. They'd just fade away into static after a while. The magnetic strips on my credit card stopped working in a day or two.
Butters chewed on his lip and nodded slowly.
The data on the jump drive would be even more fragile than a magnetic strip. It might make sense if it was some kind of erratic electromagnetic field around you. Every human body gives off a unique field of electromagnetic energy. It could be like with your cell replication, that your field is more...
Butters, I said. No time for that now. The important thing is that I don't dare touch that toy.
I frowned, thinking out loud.
Or take it back to my place, either. The wards keep magic out, but they keep it in, too. It would probably fry it to hang around in there for too long. Even working any heavy energy around it could be dangerous.
Well, that's stupid, Butters said. I mean, storing important wizard information on something that getting close to a wizard would destroy.
It's not stupid if you want to sell it to a wizard
and you're worried the buyer might off you instead of dealing in good faith, I said. Butters looked at the corpse and then back at me.
You think Gravain killed Bony Tony?
Yeah, I said. But Gravain knew that he couldn't get to the information on that jump drive on his own. Butters swallowed.
Which explains why he needed me.
Yeah. I chewed on my lip for a second and then said, Get Bony Tony back in the fridge. We're leaving. Butters nodded and went back to the examining table. He threw the cloth over the corpse.
Where?
Can you read that thing here?
No, Butters said. This computer is too old. It has the wrong ports. We could go to one of the other offices, maybe.
No, we need to get out of here. Now.
We could go to my place, Butters suggested.
No, Gravain will definitely have it under surveillance.
Damn it. Why damn it?
We're short on options, and that means we have to go someplace I didn't want to go.
Where?
He asked. A friend's. Come on.
Right, Butters said, and promptly walked over to his polka suit.
He heaved up a couple of pieces. The cymbals clashed tinnily against one another. What are you doing? I demanded. We've got to go.
I'm not leaving it here for God knows what to mess with, Butters said.
He grunted and threw a strap awkwardly over his shoulder. The bass drum rumbled. Yes, you are, I said. We're not taking it with us. We don't have time for this. Butters turned to face me, his expression stricken. That stupid polka suit filled up most of the back of the SUV. It was a pain to move it without making a bunch of noise, but in the end, we managed to slip out the back door of the Forensic Institute and make a clean getaway. I watched the road behind us carefully until I was sure that it wasn't being followed. Then I headed for the campus area and Billy's apartment. I pulled into the apartment's parking lot, leaned out, and yelled, Hey! A young man with arms and legs a few sizes too large to match his body appeared from behind the corner of the building, frowning. He was dressed in sweats, a t-shirt, and boat shoes, standard, easily discarded werewolf wardrobe for troubled times. He flipped an untidy mop of black hair out of his eyes and leaned against the SUV's door. Hey, Harry. Kirby, I greeted him. This is my friend, Butters. Kirby nodded to Butters and asked me, Did you spot me? No, but Billy always has someone on watch outside when times are tense. Kirby nodded, his expression serious. What do you need? Park this beast for me. I keep running into things. Sure. Billy and Georgia are upstairs. I got out of the car and Butters hopped out with me. Thanks, man. Yeah, Kirby said. He got in the SUV and frowned. He looked around at all the doors.
The door is ajar, the dashboard said.
It won't shut up, I explained to him.
It gets sort of zen after a while,
Butters said brightly. Life is a journey, time is a river, the door is ajar. Kirby gave him a skeptical look. I grabbed Butters by the shoulder and hauled him into the building and up to the apartment. Billy opened the door before we even got to it and looked out expectantly. He stepped a bit to one side, holding the door open for us, watching up and down the hallway. Heya, Harry. The apartment was a typical college place. Small, a couple of bedrooms, nothing permanent on the walls, furniture that wasn't too expensive or hard to move, and equipped with an expensive entertainment center. Georgia sat on the couch reading from one of a small mountain of medical books. I walked in and introduced everyone. I need a computer, I told Billy. He arched an eyebrow at me. I waved a hand in a vague motion. Tell him, Butters. Butters pulled the jump drive from his pocket and showed it to Billy.
Anything with a USB port.
Georgia frowned and asked,
What's on it?
I'm not sure, I said. I need to know. She nodded. Better let him use the one on the far wall of the computer room, Will. The farther from Harry, the better. Feel the love, I sighed. I pointed at the little table next to the door and asked, Can I make a few calls while I wait? Sure, Billy turned to Butters. Right this way. They went into one of the bedrooms. Georgia went back to her book. I picked up the phone. The phone in my place rang a dozen times before it rattled, and then Thomas slurred, What? It's me, I said. You all right? I was all right. I was asleep.
Stupid mouse woke me up to get the phone. Any sign of visitors? Calls?
No and no, he said.
Get some more sleep, I said. He made a grunting noise and hung up. I called my answering service next. They had recently phased over to stored voicemail. I was suspicious of it on general principles. From a purely logical standpoint, I knew my issues with technology wouldn't extend all the way across town over the phone lines, but all the same, I didn't trust it. I would much rather have dealt with an actual person taking messages, but it costs too much now to keep someone manning the phones when voicemail could do all the work. I punched the buttons and had to go through all the menus only twice to get it to work.
Beep! Harry, it's Murphy. We got into Hawaii all right, and there was no problem with the hotel, so you can reach me at those contact numbers. I'll call in again in a couple of...
Her voice broke off into a sudden high-pitched noise.
Would you stop that?
She demanded, with a lot more laughter than anger in her voice.
I'm on the phone.
In a couple of days, Harry. Thanks for taking care of my pants.
Plants.
Plants.
Beep.
I wondered what had caused Murphy to make a high-pitched noise and a big old Freudian slip. And I wondered what to read into the fact that she had left me a message instead of calling me at home. Probably nothing. She probably didn't want to wake me up or something. Yeah, she was probably only thinking of me.
Beep. Harry, Mike, the Beetle will be ready at noon. Beep.
God bless Mechanic Mike. If I heard a car complaining about its closed doors being open one more time, I would have to disintegrate something.
Beep.
Oh, said a young woman's voice. Mr. Dresden? It's Sheila Starr. We met at Bach-ordered books last night. There was the sound of her taking an unsteady breath.
I wondered if I could ask for a few minutes of your time. There have been... I mean, I'm not completely certain, but... I think something is wrong. Here at the store, I mean.
She let out a snippet of laughter that was half anxiety and half weariness.
Oh, hell... I probably sound crazy, but I would really like to speak to you about it. I'll be at the shop until noon, or you can call my apartment.
She gave me the number.
I hope you can come by the store, though. I would really appreciate it. Beep!
I found myself frowning. Sheila hadn't said it outright, but she had sounded pretty scared. That wasn't terribly surprising, given what she had probably seen happening right outside Bach's shop the night before. But it made me feel uncomfortable to hear fear in her voice. Or maybe it's more correct to say that I'm not comfortable with fear in any woman's voice. It's not my fault. I know it's sexist and macho and it's retrograde social evolution, but I hate it when bad things happen to women. Don't get me wrong, I hate bad things to happen to anyone. But when it's a woman that's in danger... I hate it with a reflexive, bone-deep, primal mindlessness that borders on insanity. Women are beautiful creatures, and damn it, I enjoy making sure that they're safe and treating them with old-fashioned manners and courtesy. It just seems right. I'd suffered for thinking that way more than once, but it still didn't change the way I felt. Sheila was a girl, and she was scared. Therefore, if I wanted to have any peace of mind... I was going to have to go talk to her. I checked the clock. 11. She was still at the store. I dialed one more number and got an answering machine with no message, only a tone. This is Dresden, I told the machine, and we need to talk. Butters and Billy reappeared. I hung up the phone and asked them, Well?
Numbers, said Billy.
More specific? I asked.
Butters shook his head. It's hard to be any more specific than that. There was only one file on the jump drive, and it was empty. The only information on it was the file name, and it was just a number.
He offered me a piece of white paper with a string of numerals printed on it in his spidery scrawl. I counted. There were 16 of them.
That's it.
I took the paper and frowned at the numbers.
That is spectacularly useless.
Yeah, Butters said quietly. I rubbed at the bridge of my nose.
Okay, let me think.
I tried to prioritize. Gravain was out there looking for Butters. Maybe Marcone was looking for him too.